Empty-handed.
Did they give you a reason?
They said they made the buy and were about to fly back to the U.S. when the police stopped them at the airport and confiscated the drugs.
Heroin, I said.
4 kilos. Dingo fronted them 100 large. When they came back empty-handed, I knew they were lying and should have been put to death. But Dingo said it would be bad for business if we killed 4 rich white boys. So he settled for a payout of $250,000, even though the shit would have been worth 5 times that once we cut it and put it on the street.
You don't believe the drugs were taken by the authorities at the airport?
No.
What do you think happened?
I think they set us up. They bought the dope, planted some of it on the Guatemalan kid, let him take the fall, paid off the cops, and flew back to New York with a couple kilos of Zoe Pound heroin. But we couldn't prove...
Excuse me, Kylie said.
What Guatemalan kid? The one they took with them on their fucking private jet. He was dirt poor, but he got a scholarship to their fancy white school, so they took him along for the ride, and then they hung that little brown boy out to dry.
There was a 5th kid on the drug run with them? I said. Do you know his name?
Malik nodded. Segura. Geraldo Segura.
He looked at his watch.
Your time is up.
Thank you, I said. You've been a big help, Mr. Legrand. One more quick thing. We'd like to talk to this Mr. Segura. Do you know where we can find him?
Malik laughed.
A few of his bodyguards cracked smiles as well.
Geraldo Segura is in the same place he's been for the last 20 years,
Legrand said.
The same place he'll be for the next 30.
Where's that?
The Bangkok Hilton.
My mind started to race, and I repeated the word in my head. Bangkok, 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 as in Thailand.
Chapter 32. We'd been blindsided, and Malik knew it.
Well, well, he said. It seems that the do-gooders from Silver Bullet failed to mention that they left their boyhood friend rotting away in a hellhole in Thailand.
I nodded. Do you think Segura could be connected to the bombings?
What do you mean, connected?
Could he be orchestrating the hits? I said.
Strange question, detective. I don't know what would make you think that a man chained to a prison wall in Thailand could be responsible for setting off bombs in New York. Unless...
Malik ran a hand under his chin and stroked his wiry beard.
Unless there's something you failed to mention.
Danny Corcoran had warned me about Malik.
You can fuck with him, he had said, but don't try to con him.
There is something, I said, but I didn't fail to mention it. I just wasn't going to walk in here with my kimono wide open. But now that I know there's good faith, I'll tell you. I looked around the room and then turned back to Malik.
Do we need this big a crowd?
He barked a command in Haitian Creole, and 5 of the 6 bodyguards left the room. The 6th man didn't budge.
That's my son,
Malik said. No further explanation was necessary. The bonds that killed Fairfax and Zimmer had an identical signature. They're both the handiwork of an Australian named Flynn Samuels. The problem is that Samuels has been in prison for the past 15 years. Malik Legrand had perfect teeth, and I could see almost every one of them as a wide smile crossed his face.
Let me guess. The prison is in Bangkok.
Small world, I said.
So they're cellies?
We don't know that yet. The Thai government isn't exactly forthcoming with details on their prison pop.
Does Segura have a network here in the city? Kylie asked. People who might be willing to exact revenge for him?
He's got his Guatemalan grandmother and a couple of aunts. That's his network. But I doubt if these ladies know much about blowing shit up, because if they did, they wouldn't have waited 20 years to get even.
Malik looked at his watch.
You got 1 more minute. It's not good for my reputation to have a cop car camped out in front of my market.
It's unmarked, Kylie said.
People in this neighborhood don't need the big blue letters. They can smell a cop car.
We got in a few more questions before our time ran out. We thanked him and left. As soon as we were on the road, I called Kate's at home and told her we had a new development in the Silver Bullet case.
Another bomb?
She asked. Metaphorically speaking, I guess it is. Kylie and I stopped in a coffee shop in Queens where the breakfast waitress didn't know anything about our lives and didn't care. I put in a quick call to Howard Malley at the FBI, and by 6:20 we were in Kate's office telling her about our middle-of-the-night ride to a Haitian supermarket in Canarsie.
"Was Segura in on it?"
she asked. Malik thinks he was clueless. The heroin was found in Segura's bag, but all five boys were hauled off and locked up by the Thai cops. About 10 hours later, an emissary from a Bangkok bank paid a visit to a senior police official, and the four rich kids hopped on their private jet and flew home. Segura is still there. Malik swears up and down that they only brought him along to take the fall.
"So the guy who took the rap for the drug deal is locked up in the same country as your bomb maker," Kate said. "Do you have any idea if their paths ever crossed?"
According to Howard Malley, there are 144 prisons in Thailand, with a combined male population of over 200,000, I said. It seems unlikely that the two of them met, and even more unlikely that Flynn Samuels would ever give up his trade secrets. But we're looking to see if we can make a connection.
"Where are you on the Davenport murder?" Cates asked.
"Closing in," Kylie said.
"That's not an answer I can pass up the food chain, McDonald. I need details."
"Sure. As soon as we're done here, Zach and I are going to pick up $100,000 in cash from the DA's office, hand it over to a 75-year-old man of dubious ethics, and have him deliver it to a blackmailer, who may also be a murderer. Then we'll hold our breath, keep our fingers crossed, and hope for the best."
Cates has no patience for lame cop jokes. But this time, she didn't say a word. She knew Kylie wasn't joking. Chapter 33 2 hours later, we were back in Judge Rafferty's chambers along with Jason White, our tech guru. Kylie gave his honor her most endearing smile, and I gave him an attaché case packed with cash. "There's a microchip embedded in the bottom, so we can track the money," I said.
"That won't work," Rafferty said. "There's been a change of plans. This was delivered this morning along with some instructions."
He held up a plastic bag that was identical to the ones we use at crime scenes to collect and preserve evidence. It was transparent, about the size of a sheet of typing paper, and most important, it was tamper-proof. Once the bag was sealed, if anyone attempted to open it, the adhesive strip at the top would read void. The bags we use at NYPD are imprinted with data fields to be filled in with details relevant to a crime in the chain of custody. The printing on this one was more like a bank deposit slip. It was used by millions of small businesses to make secure cash bank deposits. The blackmailer could have picked it up at any office depot in the country.
"This is where he wants me to put the money," the judge said.
"He's smart," Kylie said. "There's more than enough room for 20 stacks of Benjamins, at $5,000 per stack, but there's no place to hide a tracking device."
"Your Honor," I said. "You said it came with instructions?"
"Yes. He wants to watch me count out the money to make sure it's real and untraceable."
"Tell him he can pop by your office and look over your shoulder," Kylie said.
"He'd rather Skype. Apparently he doesn't trust me."
"I can trace a Skype call," Jason said.
"Somehow I bet he knows that. This guy's not stupid," the judge said. "He also sent this."
He handed me a small brown paper shopping bag with a Starbucks logo on it.
"What's that for?"
"He didn't say, detective. Maybe he wants me to deliver some fucking coffee along with the money."
"Did he give you any other instructions?"
"Come alone. No cops."
"That's not going to happen, Your Honor," Kylie said. "You'll be surrounded by cops. Me, Zach, and half a dozen undercover detectives who've worked operations like this before. We can't tell you too closely, but you'll be wearing an earpiece that will let us communicate with you, and a tracking device that will tell us exactly where you are."
"That's good," the judge said. "Because if you're right, and this guy is also a murderer, you'll be able to locate my body."
He lifted his arms in the air.
"Wire me up."
"It's wireless," Jason said, holding up a black audio-video transmitter that looked like a smartphone. "Just tuck it in the top pocket of your jacket and we'll be able to see what you see, hear everything you say. And when you get a call, keep your phone close to your jacket pocket and we'll be able to pick up everything the caller says."
"Excellent plan," the judge said. "But as you can see, I'm wearing this black turtleneck. I thought it was very James Bond. but alas, it has no pockets.
No problem,
Jason said. The department has a fine line of menswear for every occasion. Do you have a color preference, Your Honor?
Surprise me, Rafferty said,
sliding into the leather chair behind his desk. He picked up a folder, began to read, and tuned us out. He didn't look up until his cell phone rang 45 minutes later. He took the Skype call, which, as expected, was one-sided. The caller could see the judge, but the camera was off on the other end. Surprisingly, the 75-year-old justice was completely at ease with technology. He positioned the phone so the caller could watch, and following instructions to the letter, he removed the band from a stack of $5,000 and counted out 50 $100 bills. Then he replaced the band and slid the $5,000 into the plastic bag. The caller picked out 3 more stacks at random. When they came up clean, he told Rafferty to bag it all and seal the bag. By that time, Jason White had traced the Skype account and the phone the call was coming from. He pulled me to the far side of the room and whispered in my ear, "It belongs to a high school math teacher on the west side. I called the school security guard. She's in class."
"Can you pinpoint where the call is coming from?" I whispered back.
Jason shook his head. "I can narrow it down to a 3-block area 2 miles from the school, but pinpointing is impossible. The caller's on the move." I looked at the judge. The $100,000 was in the bag, and he ran his fingers over the tape, sealing it. Any thought we'd had of tracking the money was out the window. We had to rely solely on the eyes and ears of our undercover team.
"It's still your show,"
the judge said to the black screen on his side of the video call.
"What now?"
"Put the money inside the Starbucks bag, take a cab to 23rd Street and 10th Avenue, get out in the southwest corner and wait for my next call. And judge," the man who was calling the shots added, "at the risk of repeating myself, no cops, or I'll kill you."
That was followed by the familiar whoop sound of the Skype hang-up. The judge gave the dead phone the finger. Jason handed him a tan corduroy jacket with the camera peeking just above the breast pocket. Rafferty put on the jacket and dropped the sealed packet of money into the Starbucks mini shopping bag.
"Come on,"
he said, looking at Kylie and me and heading out the door.
"Let's go catch this flaming asshole."
Chapter 34. Malik Legrand was right. Street-smart New Yorkers, especially those who are looking to steer clear of the law, can practically smell an unmarked police car. That's why NYPD has a mini-fleet of Ford Interceptors that are painted yellow and tricked out to look exactly like the city's 13,000 licensed taxis. We call them cop cabs, and they're perfect for running surveillance in heavy crime neighborhoods, where a squad car or even an unmarked would be a dead giveaway. They also come in handy when you're tailing a blackmail victim on his way to make a $100,000 ransom drop. Judge Rafferty left the courthouse and hailed a legitimate taxi, and Kylie got behind the wheel of the decoy. I was about to get in the front passenger seat when she stopped me. "Sorry, dude," she said, "but if you want this to look authentic, you're going to have to sit in the back." If I wanted this to look authentic, I'd get someone a little less blonde and a lot less hot to do the driving. Guys will be flagging you down even if they have no place to go.
"Please don't hate me because I'm beautiful," she purred,
her green eyes wide and soulful, her lips in a mock pout. Then came the more familiar Kylie MacDonald wise-ass smirk.
"Now get in the back or find another taxi."
I got in the back, and she pulled onto Center Street. A few blocks later, she turned onto Canal, and we blended into the rolling sea of yellow cabs. His Honor had a knack for undercover work. A few minutes into the ride, he engaged the driver in classic idle taxi chit-chat. "Where are you from? How long have you been driving? How about those Mets?" Then he aimed the pocket cam at the man's hack license. By the time they reached their destination, we knew all we needed to know about the driver. Most important, he wasn't part of the shakedown. It had been a random pickup. The judge got out of the cab and stood on the corner of 10th Avenue and 23rd Street.
"I don't like it," Kylie said, parking in a bus stop on the opposite side of the avenue. "The nearest subway is on 7th, which is a solid half-mile walk from here. That means whoever is coming for the money is going to be on wheels."
"So what part don't you like?"
"The judge is too vulnerable standing there. We should move in on foot and get closer to him, just in case a van swoops in and tries to pick up the old man along with the money. I was about to get out of the cab when Rafferty's cell phone rang. Kylie and I listened as he took the call.
"I'm on the damn street corner," he barked at the caller. "Now what?"
"Walk west on 23rd, the voice said.
We watched as the judge headed west.
"I've got a bum knee," he said. "How far do I have to walk?"
"Half a block. That big green box in the middle of the sidewalk is an elevator. Take it up to the second floor."
"Son of a bitch," Kylie said, pointing at the trestle 30 feet above the street. "He's meeting the judge on the High Line."
The High Line is one of New York City's most inspired public parks. It's the brainchild of two men who saw an unused elevated railroad spur and helped convert it into a mile-and-a-half-long aerial garden that winds above the city from Gansevoort Street in the Meatpacking District to Hudson Yards on 34th Street. I radioed Danny Corcoran.
"The drop is on the High Line at 23rd.
We need to block off the closest exit so the perp can't get back down to street level. Kylie and I have this one covered. Get a team to cut him off at 20th and another at 26th.
"Box him in,"
Corcoran said.
"I'm on it."
"One more thing," I said. "Get a bird up there. We need eyes in the sky."
I turned to Kylie.
"Take the stairs. I'll meet you up top."
I ran toward the elevator. It was the slowest way to get where I wanted to go, but I had to make sure that the money that had just gone up wasn't already on the way down. It wasn't. The elevator was empty, and I got on. Kylie was waiting for me at the top. Even though I was in full-blown cop and pursuit mode, I couldn't help but be dazzled by the beautiful greenway floating above Manhattan's west side. It was a triumph of urban development that attracted 5 million tourists a year. I took Kylie by the hand, and we pretended to be two of them.
"Start walking north,"
the voice on the judge's phone ordered.
His Honor, who was only 50 yards away, saw us, nodded, and started walking. We did the same, walking at his pace, pretending to admire the vegetation as we went.
"Red leader," Danny said over the radio. "Aviation is on the way and backup is in place. Do you want them to close in?"
"Not yet," I said. "Judge is headed north. Keep a tight lock on the exit at 26th. Backup at 20th can start moving uptown."
The judge was almost at 25th Street when the voice came back.
"There's a bench up ahead. When you get there, I want you to set your little shopping bag on it and keep walking."
Not only could Kylie and I see the judge from a safe distance, but we could also look at my iPhone and see exactly what his pocket cam was seeing. There was a beautifully crafted teak bench nestled in front of a thick patch of greenery. The judge slowed down as he approached the bench, lowered the bag with the extortion money onto the seat, and then kept walking. I radioed Danny, gave him the exact drop location, and told him to position his remaining backup team on the avenue directly below us.
"Do you see anybody?"
Kylie asked.
I looked around.
Not many people,
and those who were there were strolling, oblivious to the mini shopping bag sitting on a bench, tucked into a quiet nook surrounded by nature.
"Nobody," I said, looking left, right, north, and south. What I didn't do was look up, so I didn't see the quadcopter as it stealthily moved in on its target. I didn't hear the buzz of the tiny rotors slicing through the air until it was too late. The drone swooped down from the sky and hovered over the bench. Within seconds, a grappling hook that was suspended from the landing gear latched onto the handles of the Starbucks bag, lifted it up, and banked west.
"Aviation!" I yelled, keying my radio. "Red leader on the High Line, where are you? We need air support, and we need it now!"
"Zach, what's going on?"
It was Danny Corcoran.
"We got sucker punched," I said, as I watched $100,000 of District Attorney Mick Wilson's money fly low over the Hudson River and make its way uptown. Chapter 35. Ordinary mortals watching all that cash disappear into thin air might shake their fists at the sky and give up. Not cops, especially not me or Kylie. We ran after it. Instinctively, we both headed toward the 26th Street exit. It wasn't where our car was, but it was the fastest way to the ground. By the time we got there, Judge Rafferty was surrounded by six cops, Danny Corcoran, his partner, Tommy Fisher, and four uniforms. I've got the chopper pilot on the radio, Corcoran said. He's tracking the drone. It looked like a fly speck at first, but he finally got his camera locked in on it. We're going after it, I said. You and Tommy get the judge out of here fast.
I'm fine, detective, Rafferty said. Don't worry about me.
I'm not worried about you, Your Honor. I'm worried about your picture being all over the internet in the next 5 minutes. I swept my hand in an arc around the growing crowd that had come to take in the beauty of the High Line and got the extra added bonus of being in the middle of a police action. Most of their cell phone cameras were still pointed skyward, but some of them started to advance from the cluster of cops at the top of the stairs.
We need wheels, Kylie yelled. Who's got an RMP?
One of the uniforms reached into his pocket and pulled out a key fob. Contrary to what you see in the movies, cops don't bolt from their cars and leave their motors running. The vehicle is their responsibility, so when it's unattended, most of them lock it. He tossed Kylie the keys, clearly not happy about giving up his ride.
And who are you? He grinned. Get the name, share the blame, detective.
Kylie McDonald, Red Unit. I've got a decoy cop cab parked at 23 and 10. It's all yours.
She read the name on his uniform.
Officer Pendleton.
She gave him her keys, and the two of us flew down the stairs. Within seconds, we were tear-assing up 10th Avenue. I got the chopper pilot on the radio.
Aviation, this is Red Leader. What's the 20 on that drone?
The UAV, Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, he said, correcting me. Is about 800 feet over 30th and 9th and headed east. He's only poking along at about 20 miles an hour.
My kid has one that goes faster. This one is carrying $100,000 in cash, I said.
That wouldn't slow my kid down, but Red Leader, do not, repeat, do not turn onto 30th. There's an 18-wheeler backing into a loading dock. He's jamming up the whole street. Head east on 34th. Kylie slowed down just enough to hang a hard right onto 34th. It's a wide, busy crosstown thoroughfare, four lanes with two-way traffic. But at least it was moving. Cars, trucks, buses, and pedestrians all got out of our way as she barreled down the street, lights flashing, siren wailing, creating a center lane of her own.
UAV is descending, the pilot said. That will cut his speed dramatically. He's at 31st and 7th Avenue. I have you in the RMP at 34th crossing 8th.
By the time he finished his sentence, Kylie had whizzed past an accordion-fold articulated bus, and we were halfway to 7th.
Red Leader, the UAV is 300 feet and dropping, the pilot said. Looks like he's going to set it down. The avenue is crowded. I may lose him. You're going to need eyes on the ground.
I radioed Central, told them the drone was hovering over Penn Station, and asked for every cop in the area to start looking up.
It's carrying $100,000 of department funds, I added. Arrest anyone who touches it.
Turn right, our eyes in the sky said.
The traffic in front of us was stopped for a red light, so Kylie yanked the car to the left and hopped over the double yellow line into the westbound lane. And she blasted a couple of whoop-whoops on the siren, made a sharp right across two lanes of eastbound traffic, and skidded onto 7th Avenue. I bent down low in the front seat and looked up through the canyon of skyscrapers.
Nothing.
Aviation, I still don't have a visual, I yelled into the mic. Where is he?
He's at your 12 o'clock, headed straight toward you over Penn Station and still descending. He's at 50 feet, 40, 30, and...
Camera lost him. He's gone.
What do you mean, gone?
He dipped under the canopy at 32nd and 7th, the one over the main entrance to Penn Station that cuts through to Madison Square Garden.
Stop your car, right there by that taxi rank.
Kylie jammed on the brakes, stopping the RMP in the middle of one of the busier crosswalks in Manhattan. We jumped out of the car. Several uniformed officers who had seen the drone go down came racing toward us.
The white drone, one of them said. Is it carrying a bomb?
No, Kylie said.
Stolen money. Did you see where it went?
It flew under this overhang and disappeared, the cop said.
Find it,
Kylie barked at the growing cadre of men and women in uniform. The lot of us stampeded down the steps into the massive underground catacomb that sits below Madison Square Garden. Unlike its east side sister, Grand Central Terminal, Penn Station is devoid of charm. Its main claim to fame is its capacity. I looked up at the departures board. Trains were coming and going minutes apart. Over 500,000 passengers a day passed through the vast space. Tens of thousands of them with rolling suitcases, any one of which could have contained the UAV and the ransom money.
Detective, our eyewitness cop said, I saw that drone fly in here, and I know for sure it didn't fly out. It's got to be somewhere inside the station.
Somewhere inside the station, Kylie said, looking at me. That's good news. Now all we have to do is find something the size of a couple of coat hangers inside the biggest transportation hub in the Western Hemisphere. Chapter 36. Success has many fathers. When a police action goes down perfectly, there's never a shortage of people ready to take credit for it. That's why there's always a crowd of high-ranking cops standing behind the podium when the PC holds a press conference, announcing the department's latest triumph over crime. Failure, on the other hand, is an orphan, and the top brass is notorious for pointing fingers and assigning blame. One of the things that makes Delia Cates a great boss is her willingness to stand back-to-back with her team, even when the wheels come flying off the wagon. She was at her computer when we got to her office. The door was open, and Kylie rapped on the glass.
Captain, can we have—
Sit down, Kate said, without looking up from the keyboard.
I'm just answering my fan mail. It's amazing how my inbox fills up when $100,000 of the DA's money flies off into the sunset.
Ma'am, you don't have to fall on your sword for us, Kylie said. We lost the money and the perp. We'll take the heat. Kate's lifted her head up.
McDonald, in case you haven't noticed, I'm black, I'm a woman, and I'm on the fast track. I don't have to fall on swords. There are plenty of white men in white shirts who are happy to throw me on the nearest one if they think it will help a horse they have in the race.
She slid the keyboard tray under her desktop. Besides, as the DA's latest email just reminded me, I'm the one who called, asked for the money, and practically promised him we'd all live happily ever after.
How did you respond? My first draft said, Dear Mick, shit happens.
The version I ultimately sent him said the same thing, but it benefited from time well spent during my youth in the writing program at Columbia.
Have you heard from the Chief of D's, or the PC? Kylie asked.
All of the above and many of those below. Listen to me, McDonald. Running a high-profile squad is like coaching in the Super Bowl. Everybody's rooting for you until you make one bonehead play. I can go from deep shit to high glory overnight, then back to the crapper before lunch. But that's my job. Yours is to catch bad guys. So stop asking about the politics and start clearing cases.
That's why we're here, I said. We need your approval to put Troy Marchand and Dylan Fremont on round-the-clock surveillance.
And who are they?
Marchand was Aubrey Davenport's assistant. Mr. Fremont is his fiancé.
What do you have on them?
Nothing yet, I said. Marchand has been very helpful. If you remember, Aubrey Davenport's computer was missing, and he's the one who retrieved her files from... Cates held up a hand.
I remember the missing computer all too well, Jordan. Catch the blackmailer. Find the computer. We all know how that worked out.
Get to the part where you explain why you want to tail these two men.
The day we met Troy Marchand, he told us that Aubrey was obsessed with two things, sex and filmmaking. When he retrieved her files from the cloud, we figured there'd be dozens of explicit videos. But it was all vanilla. Naked selfies between her and Yannick don't exactly qualify as an obsession with sex and filmmaking.
What about Aubrey's romp with the judge? Kate said. I'd say that qualifies.
Yes, ma'am. But we got that video from Q. There were no sex films in any of the files Marchand gave us.
Kate sat back in her chair, and I could see the realization spread across her face.
Then how did Mr. Marchand even know that these dirty movies existed? She said.
That's the light bulb that just went off in our heads. We think Marchand and Fremont got hold of Aubrey's computer and decided to go into the blackmail business.
They could be a lot more than blackmailers, Kate said. Do they have an alibi for the night of the murder?
I responded with half a shrug. We never asked.
Why the hell not?
Captain, you saw the photos from Roosevelt Island, Kylie said, jumping in.
It was a sex crime. Chuck Dryden, who almost never goes out on a limb without hard evidence, said that the killer was most likely a man. I guess we made the natural logic leap to heterosexual man.
So you profiled them, Kate said, and you decided that being gay was an alibi.
Not our finest moment, Kylie said. But in our defense, it was the end of a grueling night that started out with a bomb blast and went downhill from there.
If you're right, Kate said, and the blackmail scheme was a crime of opportunity, then it makes sense that Marchand and Fremont are the opportunists who pulled it off. They've already had one major score, and since the judge probably isn't the only one caught on camera with his pants down, they'll probably go after the other potential blackmail targets next.
Yes, ma'am, Kylie said. So can you approve a budget to tail them?
I'll pay for the manpower, Kate said, but it doesn't warrant round the clock. One team, 12 hours a day, and when the ransom demands come in, don't ask me for another nickel. After what went down this morning, if you told me the perp was in Jersey, I wouldn't pay your tolls for the trip over the George Washington Bridge.
Chapter 37 As soon as Kylie and I broke the news to Corcoran and Fisher that they were the designated hitters to shadow the two suspects in the drone heist, we were able to pick up where we'd left off after our pre-dawn meeting with Malik Legrand. 30 minutes later, we walked into the lobby of a 40-story green glass tower on Maiden Lane in the financial district.
You know what I hate about this job?
Kylie asked as we stepped into an elevator.
I'm sure you've got a list, I said. But since we're only going to the 12th floor, how about you just give me your bitch du jour?
Ass-kissing, she said, as soon as the elevator door closed.
Can you elaborate?
Nathan Hirsch came to us with his big confession about running drugs for Zoe Pound. But he left out the most important part, she said. I mean, why tell us the whole truth when all he wanted us to do was arrest Malik?
The guy's a slimeball with a wife and kids in Queens and a hooker on call in Jersey, I said. Are you surprised that he lied to you?
No, they all lie, Zach. But if Hirsch were a run-of-the-mill asshole, we'd drag him into an interview room and scare the crap out of him. But since he's a privileged asshole, we're heading upstairs to his office, and we've got to smile politely, pucker up, and kiss his butt while he keeps lying to us.
I believe you just summed up the mission statement of our unit, I said. To protect and serve the privileged assholes.
Thanks for reminding me, she said. I'll give it a shot. Let me do the talking.
The elevator door opened on 12. There were 5 names on the wall, one of which was Hirsch's. We went through the standard meet and greet with the receptionist. No, we didn't have an appointment, but tell Mr. Hirsch that Detectives Jordan and McDonald are here, and we're sure he'll find the time. In less than a minute, we were sitting in Hirsch's office, where the familiar aroma of cigar smoke and flop sweat permeated the air.
Did you arrest Legrand?
He asked.
He said he didn't do it, Kylie said.
There's a shocker, Hirsch said.
A drug dealer who lies to the cops.
Was he lying about Geraldo Segura?
She snapped, neither smiling nor puckering up.
Is that why you're here?
He said, raising his voice.
Legrand told you about Segura, and I didn't, so you've come to the erroneous conclusion that I have something to hide.
Do you?
No, but the fact that Segura is in prison is irrelevant.
Not to us, Kylie said. According to Legrand, Segura was innocent. You brought him along to take the fall if the drug run went south.
I brought him along,
Hirsch said, his fists clenched, his face turning red.
The entire operation, start to finish, was Princeton's. He set up the deal with Dingo. He provided the plane, and the rest of us didn't even know Segura was coming along for the ride until he showed up at the hangar. I was a kid. I was stoned half the time. And if Segura was set up to take the fall, blame Princeton Wells. He was the mastermind.
And what if Segura doesn't know that? She said.
What do you mean?
What if he blames all 4 of you? Wouldn't that make him a prime suspect?
No. It makes him someone who might want to kill us, not someone who can actually pull off the bombings. In case you forgot, Detective, Geraldo Segura is serving 50 years in a prison in Thailand.
You know who else is doing time in a prison in Thailand? Kylie said. The man who designed the bombs that killed Del Fairfax and Arnie Zimmer. Hirsch sat there, mouth open, head cocked, eyes squinting. What do you mean?
Bombs have signatures, she said. The ones that killed your partners are the handiwork of a man named Flynn Samuels, who's also locked up in Thailand, and who may have taught Segura the tricks of his trade.
Hirsch's pasty white face turned an even ghostlier shade of pale.
But Geraldo is in prison!
That might slow him down, but it won't stop him. If Geraldo Segura has the motive and the method, the only thing he would need to actually pull off the bombings is an accomplice in New York.
Like who?
We don't think his grandmother infiltrated the Pierre Hotel, but you'd be amazed at the kind of freelance talent that's available for the right price.
Segura is dirt poor, and his family—
Hirsch stopped.
Oh my God.
What?
Silver Bullet has been sending the grandmother money. It was Princeton's idea. He told her it was a privilege to be able to help Geraldo's family. But in reality, it's just blood money.
How much?
$50,000 a year. For the past 20 years.
So let's see, Kylie said. 50,000 times 20. Wow. You better hope that Granny isn't the vindictive type. Because $1 million would buy her a hell of a lot of firepower.
She nodded to me.
Let's go, Zack.
Wait!
Hirsch said.
What do I do?
Kylie handed him her business card.
Call us if you think of something. We can't help if we don't know what's going on.
She turned, and the two of us left his office and walked to the elevator.
So how'd I do? She said.
A refresher course in sensitivity training couldn't hurt, I said. But one thing's for sure. Nathan Hirsch is never going to lie to you again.
Chapter 38. Even with light traffic on the FDR Drive, it took us more than half an hour to get to Princeton Wells' mansion on Central Park West.
You realize he knows we're coming, Kylie said. Hirsch probably called him the minute we left, so he's had more than enough time to rehearse his answers.
Since when do people need time to rehearse the truth? I said, ringing the front doorbell.
Since when have any of these people been remotely truthful?
I could see that Wells had a change in attitude as soon as he opened the door. The preppy billionaire was wearing jeans, a faded work shirt, a perfectly wrinkled hunter green cashmere V-neck sweater, and bright red Nikes, but not a trace of a smile.
I spoke to Nathan, he grumbled, leading us up the stairs to his office. He's out of his mind.
Understandable, I said. He's afraid he's next on the killer's hit list.
I didn't say he's out of his mind with fear, Wells snapped. I'm saying the man is out of his fucking mind. What was he thinking, sending you off to accuse Malik Legrand of those murders?
You don't think Malik is responsible?
We entered Wells's office.
No,
he said, slamming the door shut.
I have no doubt that if Malik were in charge 20 years ago, he'd have killed us all. Luckily for us, Dingo called the shots. But I knew Dingo wouldn't be around forever, so I reached out to Malik, quietly, privately. And over time, we reached a peaceful accord. A détente, if you will.
So are we talking about a handshake agreement here? Kylie asked.
Wells finally cracked a faint smile.
I didn't so much shake his hand as grease his palm, regularly.
You pay him not to kill you.
It's basic street economics. The same as the local pizza parlor paying the mob for protection. It was an insurance policy in case Malik ever got to be the boss.
And now that he is, do you think he kept his word? I asked.
Yes. I don't think he killed Arnie or Dell, but now that Nathan is gone and sicked the cops on him, I hope he doesn't go off the deep end and kill us for lack of respect. The Zoes are bad to the bone. They don't resolve problems. They eliminate them. Malik's son killed a total stranger in a bar just for looking at him funny.
Tell us about your friend Geraldo Segura, Kylie said.
Friend, Wells said, spitting out the word. More like a hustler, but none of us knew it at the time. He was the scrappy little scholarship kid from El Barrio, and we were the hotshit Upper East Side rich kids. You'd think that he'd idolize us, that he'd want what we had. But that's not the way it played out. It wasn't long before we all wanted to be him.
What do you mean?
When you're 19, being rich and white with your future all planned out for you is like a death sentence.
Peralta lived on the edge. He was a street fighter, fast on his feet, and even faster with his fists. The girls loved him. When he was 15, he was banging this 18-year-old, and her two brothers jumped him. They both wound up eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner through a straw for the better part of a year.
"And you wanted to be him?" I said.
He nodded. "I'm guessing you were never a big fan of gangster rap, were you, detective?"
"Not my kind of music," I said.
"It was mine. N.W.A., Tupac, Wu-Tang. It's about struggling against life in the ghetto, and I identified. Geraldo and I just came from different ghettos."
"Tell us about the drug run for Dingo Slide," I said.
We were coming up on Christmas break. I told Geraldo we were going to Bangkok on my father's plane and asked if he wanted to come along. He said no. I said, "We're going to get drunk, we're going to get stoned, we're going to get laid," and he said, "Me too, and I don't have to go halfway around the world to do it." The next day, he went from no to maybe. He knew Dingo was our dealer, and he told us he knew how we could get 3-4 months' supply of coke free. All we had to do was bring back a small package from Thailand.
"And you knew what was in the package?"
"Hell yeah! That's what made it exciting. I wouldn't pick up somebody's laundry for free cocaine, but smuggling heroin from Thailand? Do you have any idea what kind of a rush that was?"
"Malik said you're the one who cut the deal with Dingo."
"Dingo knew me. I was a good customer. I guess he trusted me as much as any Haitian drug lord can trust a rich white kid. It was all Geraldo's idea, but I got to be the front man. I loved it."
"How come he's in prison and you're not?"
"My father paid the Thais a fortune to let us go. But they would only release 4 of us. They needed someone to stay behind. It's their perverted way of showing their justice system works. The last thing I did before I left Geraldo was make a promise that we'd take care of his family. We have."
"Did Nathan Hirsch tell you that Segura may have crossed paths with the man who designed the bombs?"
"Yes. But Nathan is an idiot if he thinks Geraldo's abuela is funding these bombings."
"Can you think of anyone here in the States who might be acting on his behalf?"
"No, but I'm not the right person to ask."
"Who is?"
"Geraldo Segura."
"That's impossible."
"Bullshit. 2 of my partners are dead, and I'm starting to believe, Nathan, that he and I are next on the list. So, do me a favor. Get your glorified super cop asses on the next plane to Bangkok and keep that from happening."
"I don't know what that would cost," I said. "But I'm pretty sure the department isn't going to shell out the kind of money it would take to fly us to Thailand."
"You never know till you ask, detective."
"I wouldn't even know who to ask."
"Then we're in luck," Wells said. "Because as it turns out, I do."
Chapter 39. I was back in the office when my cell phone rang. The caller ID said Silver Cup Studios. I picked up.
"Zach, it's Bob Reitzfeld. How's your day going so far?"
I looked at my watch. It was 3 p.m.
"Let's see, I've been at it for 12 hours, and so far I've had to suck up to a Haitian drug lord in the back room of a supermarket in Brooklyn, been chewed out by a billionaire, lied to by a lawyer, and wait, I know there's one more thing. Oh yeah, despite the fact that I had a 6-man backup team, I managed to lose $100,000 of the DA's money. On the plus side, I got to spend some time on the High Line. It's quite spectacular. I'm hoping next weekend I can go back there with Cheryl. And how's your day going, Bob?"
"I need your help."
"Why? Did someone zip-tie you to another water pipe?"
"I think I know who hired those 2 lowlifes who pulled off the poker game robbery."
I inhaled sharply. "Hold on a minute." Kylie had gone to the break room for coffee, but she'd be back any second. And this wasn't a phone call I wanted to have with her sitting at the next desk. I took the stairs up to the 4th floor, found an empty interview room, and shut the door.
"Bob, I'm sorry if I sounded like a jerk. It's what happens when you ask an overworked cop how his day's going.
Who do you like for the robbery?"
"Is Kylie within earshot? I don't want her to pick up on your reaction."
"No, we're good. I'm alone."
"I'm pretty sure it's her boyfriend who planned the whole operation. His name is C.J. Berenger. Do you remember meeting him the other night?"
Did I remember meeting him? I dug deep into Clyde Jerome Berenger's past, hoping to find something I could use against him.
but since Reitfeld had told me to mind my own business, I couldn't admit to him how much I knew.
Yeah, I met CJ, I said. Tall guy, professional poker player.
What makes you think it's him?
Because it's clearly an inside job. At first, I thought it might be someone connected to the hotel. A desk clerk, someone from room service, a bellman. But I interviewed anyone and everyone at the Mark who knew about the game, and they all came up clean. So I decided to focus on the people in the room.
Uh-huh, I said, leaving out the fact that I'd gone down the exact same road 2 nights ago.
And how did you land on Berenger? Zack, the man sticks out like a boner in a Speedo, Reitfeld said. Everyone else is a regular. Same faces month after month, year after year. This Berenger character starts dating Kylie, gets her to introduce him to Shelley, plays twice, which is all it takes to get the routine down pat, and bingo! The third time he's in the room, the game gets hit by a couple of bozos who couldn't organize a two-car funeral if you spotted them a hearse and six pallbearers.
Can you prove anything?
Probably. If Shelley would let me.
What do you mean, if?
When I told him I thought Berenger could be the brains behind the hit, he told me to back off. I love the old man, but he just doesn't think like a cop.
That's why he made you head of security at Silver Cup Studios.
It's a great title, Zack. Very impressive on my business card. I've never seen Shelley's business card, but it should say Control Freak. He doesn't want me to follow up on CJ because he doesn't want Kylie to get hurt. He says her husband has caused her enough pain, and he would rather protect her than recover $800,000.
That's insane, I said. I know Kylie. If her boyfriend is guilty, she'd want you to nail him.
That's why I'm calling you. You're her partner. Shelley won't listen to me, but he'll listen to you.
I'm not so sure.
It can't hurt to ask him.
Yes, it can. If I tell him to go after Berenger and he says no, I can't then turn around and do it anyway. But if I don't say anything...
Don't ask permission. Ask forgiveness, Reitfeld said. But you'd have to investigate on your own. Do you mind?
Did I mind proving Kylie's latest was a crook? I grinned.
I can deal with it. Give me a few days. Thanks. So tell me about losing the DA's $100,000.
How about I tell you over a beer at my retirement party, which will be coming around a lot sooner than I planned if I don't find the money? He hung up, and I sat there staring at my phone. I was planning my next move when a text message popped up on the screen. It was from Kylie.
Where are you?
I tapped out an answer. I was meditating. Thanks for harshing my zen. She texted back.
Your zen can wait. Kate's wants us.
I let her know I was on my way, then hit Q's number on my speed dial. He answered on the first ring.
Detective Jordan, he said. Rumor has it that you and Judge Rafferty had quite a costly adventure on the High Line.
The good news is His Honor no longer thinks you're blackmailing him.
For which you have my undying gratitude, Q replied. If you ever need any...
Forget if you ever. I'm collecting now. I filled him in on the poker game robbery that went down at the Mark.
So you want me to be on the lookout for two gentlemen of dubious earning power who are spending money like a couple of scratch-off winners?
Yes, I said. And Q, this one is between me, you, and nobody else.
Please, detective, he said. You know my reputation. I'm as discreet as a whisper in a windstorm.
And you know my partner, I said. If she finds out, I'll be as dead as a flounder in a frying pan.
I hung up and headed for my meeting with Kate's. As I double-timed down the stairs, I realized I was smiling. I know it's not healthy, but for me there's something gratifying about proving to the woman who dumped me for another man that once again, she'd made the wrong choice.
Chapter 40
Uh-oh, Kylie said, as the two of us walked down the hall to Kate's office. Her door was shut, the privacy blinds on the glass wall were down, and there were two large men standing directly outside her office. I knew them well. Mayor Sykes's bodyguards.
Well, if it isn't Cagney and Lacey, Kylie said.
never missing an opportunity to bust balls. Glad to see that the taxpayers were smart enough to pay two of you to protect the mayor from the evils that lurk in the halls of an Upper East Side police precinct.
Ah, the ever-delightful Detective MacDonald,
the larger of the two men said, putting his hand on the doorknob.
Let's see if you're still smiling when you come back out.
He held the door open, and Kylie and I went in. Cates was behind her desk. Sykes was sitting across from her.
He's taking hostages,
the mayor said, as soon as the door closed behind us.
Ma'am,
I said, who's taking hostages?
Princeton Wells. The Silver Bullet Foundation was supposed to break ground on Tremont Gardens next month.
In case we hadn't been paying attention to the speeches on the night of the hotel bombing, she added,
it's the city's permanent housing project for homeless people that Del Fairfax designed. But Wells is putting it on hold until the person or persons responsible for the deaths of his two partners are brought to justice.
That's emotional blackmail, Kylie said.
But that's how billionaires work the system, Detective.
Madam Mayor, we're doing everything we can.
Not according to Wells. He told me the whole story of this drug deal he and his cohorts got caught up in when they were kids.
Excuse me, ma'am, Kylie said. But he probably only gave you his account of the whole story. There are other versions.
Don't waste my time asking if I believe a drug dealer or a philanthropist, Sykes said. All I know is that the bomb maker is in a prison in Thailand, and this Geraldo Segura, who has a deep-seated grudge against Wells and the others, is also incarcerated in Thailand. Captain Cates has just confirmed that.
But we don't know if the two men ever met, Kylie said.
Mr. Wells refuses to wait for the Thai government to be forthcoming with that information. He tells me he suggested that the two of you fly to Thailand and find out for yourselves. Your response was that the city would never pay your travel expenses.
Not the city, Kylie said. The department.
MacDonald, Kate said. Stop talking and start listening.
Captain, Kylie said. After what happened this morning on the High Line, we were under the impression that the department wouldn't pay for... Kate stood up.
Stop talking now.
Thank you, Delia,
the mayor said.
She turned to the two of us. First, I assured Mr. Wells that this administration would go to the ends of the earth to hunt down the people who murdered two of our city's most generous benefactors, and that cost was definitely not a factor. He then pointed out to me that he knows exactly how our system works. You can't just jump on a plane to Bangkok without jumping through a lot of bureaucratic hoops. It would take days for the pencil pushers and the number crunchers to approve your travel expenses. I told him I could cut through a lot of that red tape with one phone call to the police commissioner, and that you'd be on your way within 24 hours. He laughed and said he could cut through all of the red tape and have you wheels up by 7:30 tonight.
Ma'am, Kylie said, Wells talks a good game, but how is that even possible?
Anything is possible when you own a fleet of corporate jets. Wells will have a plane and a flight crew waiting for you at Teterboro.
Isn't that... Kylie stopped herself.
Isn't that what?
Sykes asked.
Nothing, ma'am. It's not important.
It's important to me, because once you get on that plane, I want you to have no other concerns besides tracking down Geraldo Segura. Now, ask the question.
Zack and I are city employees. Aren't we bound by the law that prohibits us from accepting gifts for anything valued over $75?
Yes, but as mayor of this city, I can issue an executive order waiving that law due to the dire emergency of the situation. Any more questions?
No, ma'am.
Then dust off your passports and pack your bags, because in 3 hours the two of you are leaving for Thailand.
Chapter 41. I went straight to Cheryl's office.
Something came up, I said.
Judging by the hangdog look on your face, I'm guessing it's something that's going to screw up our dinner reservations at Paula's.
Sorry, I have to cancel.
I've been looking forward to our carciofi alla Giudea all day, so you better have a good reason for bailing on me.
Kylie and I are going to Thailand.
She laughed. No, seriously.
I'm not kidding, we're leaving tonight.
Tonight?
The Silver Bullet bombings. All roads lead to Thailand.
Oh, Zack, she said, picking up her cell.
What's your flight number? At least I can follow you on flight view.
Actually, I said, knowing that there was no way to sugarcoat what I was about to say, we're not going commercial. We're flying out of Teterboro on Princeton Wells's corporate jet.
You, Kylie, and Wells?
I doubt if Wells is going to go to Thailand. Ever. I think he only flies into countries he knows he can fly out of.
So it's just you and Kylie on a private plane?
And the crew, I added lamely.
Do you realize that as a city employee it's against the law for you to accept—
I know. It's a long story. I don't have time to give you the details. My flight leaves at 7:30. I've got to go home and pack. I put my arms around her. I just came to say goodbye.
Not here, she said, backing off. Let's go. I'll help you pack.
She grabbed her purse, and I followed her out of the office. My apartment was a short cab ride away, but 4:30 in the afternoon is not the best time for finding a taxi, so we snagged a ride uptown with a couple of uniforms. It was fast and cheap, but it's impossible to have a personal conversation when you're riding with two chatty cops in a squad car. I waited till we got in the elevator. Look, Cheryl, I know this sucks. I'm really sorry.
For what? You didn't do anything wrong.
No, but Kylie and I are going to be flying God knows how many hours in this luxury airplane and—
So, then, is this another one of your famous prophylactic apologies? Or are you just projecting that I'm jealous?
None of the above, but— The elevator stopped on the 10th floor and we got out.
But what?
Are you jealous?
Zack, you're a cop. Kylie's your partner. You spend 60 hours a week with her in the same office, the same car, on stakeouts together, eating meals together. It's what you do. So what's the difference if you do it on a private plane? What's the difference if you do it 8,000 miles and 11 time zones away, in an exotic country, with gorgeous beaches, exciting nightlife, and luxurious hotels? Why would I be jealous? If I trust you here, I trust you there.
I wasn't 100% sure I could wade through the subtext, so I took the high road. I said nothing. I unlocked my door and we entered the apartment. As soon as we were inside, Cheryl grabbed me, pressed me against the wall, and kissed me hard.
You realize I'm not here to help you pack, don't you?
She said, pulling her sweater over her head and dragging me toward the bedroom. Packing is highly overrated, I said, shucking my clothes along the way, my libido kicking into overdrive. One of the things I love about my sex life with Cheryl is that she has never once been hesitant to let me know what she needs. There are times when our lovemaking is practically puritanical. Sweet, slow, gentle. Skin to skin. Heart to heart. Soul to soul. This was not one of those times. This was raw sex. Frenzied. Loud. Primal. I doubt if we lasted more than 10 minutes, but they were 10 of the most incredible minutes of my adult life. I lay there on my bed, wrapped in her arms, completely spent, deliriously happy. That, I said, still breathing heavily, was the best going-away present I ever got.
Wait till you see the welcome home present I have planned for you,
she whispered, her tongue teasing my ear, her fingertips making small circles against my nipple. I felt myself stirring. You keep that up, and I may not wait till I get back home to collect. She kept it up. I collected. This time the sex was unhurried, sensuous, tender. Each of us caught up in the act of making love, neither of us racing to the finish line.
You're getting pretty good at this,
she said, as we curled up for the second time. Thanks. I'd be even better if I'd had any sleep last night. I've been up since 3.
Don't worry. You'll sleep on the plane.
I hope so. I don't sleep well on airplanes.
You'll sleep like a log on this one.
She pressed her body closer to mine, and I could feel her warm breath on my ear.
Trust me,
she said.
I'm a doctor.
Chapter 42 Princeton Wells thought of everything. At 5:30, I got a call from a man named Mateo, who asked me what I'd care to eat en route. I'm easy, I said. Whatever you've got on the plane.
At the moment, the cupboard is bare, but I'm about to call our in-flight catering service, he said. They feed some of the world's most demanding clientele. So please tell me what foods you enjoy, and they will be on board.